I tell you what, we turn our attention to racing. We enjoy the sport. We love the sport. We're not as passionately involved as we are for the winter month sport that we immerse ourselves in. And we've lost one of the great voices to that sport over the last 12 to 24 months. But we are forever thankful that we can turn on Channel 7 and we can hear and see the great Bruce McAvaney talk about racing up in Randwick for the Everest and at Caulfield for the Caulfield Cup. And it's a great pleasure he joins us on the program. Bruce, good morning.
Good to talk to you, Gary, and you too, Tim. And Gary, can I start? I haven't spoken to you since, but I think we're all still thinking about the D's, and I was thrilled for all their supporters, and in particular you. So what a finish, eh?
Thanks, Bruce. It really was, and we understand the situation we're in here in Melbourne. We're still in lockdown, so we haven't got to really celebrate with our former mates and teammates and all those sorts of things, and yeah. I guess we'll go and relive it all again, but it was an extraordinary experience, and grand finals outside of Melbourne can work, can't they?
They can, and I'm convinced now that we should have a rotation system. I mean, I think we're all thinking about that. I was in Brisbane for the first one, and that was good, and this looked great. I know the MCC and the MCG have got such a tight deal with the AFL, and we understand that, but I would have thought that a moment has arrived where we can rethink things a little, and maybe, every 5 years, have it in another place. I just know if South Australia knew that they were having the grand final in 2027, the build-up would be enormous. It would be, it'd be the biggest thing happening in that our state in that year. So I hope it happens. Not sure it will, but I hope it does.
Good morning to you, Macca. What did you think of Christian Petrarca's performance in the grand final?
Tim, it was astonishing. He played such a brilliant final series. And that battle with Bontempelli, all the way through that grand final, halfway through the third quarter, Bontempelli had his nose in front. But, Tim, I haven't seen anything quite like it. I've seen Dusty, and obviously we've all seen Dusty in all his glory, Gary Ablett Sr. There have been other phenomenal finals players over the years, but I don't think we've ever seen anything as outstanding. The next 3 or 4 years are going to be fascinating to see where he's going to finally sit. But at the moment, I think it's, Ablett's 9 goals, and there's been one or two other performances, but I would have thought this was as good as I've ever seen.
It was an extraordinary game, wasn't it? Like, I had to go back. We talked about this post the grand final, but I actually had to go back on the Sunday and watch it again because I couldn't quite believe how quickly that game spun and turned around again in that third quarter.
Look, Tim, if people will look at the results, and Gary, in 50 years' time, if I hadn't seen the game, I think, oh, gee, that was a one-sided match. It was anything but. I mean, up until three-quarter time, it's probably as good a grand final as I've ever seen. And then the last quarter was a celebration. What struck me, all year I was thinking, we don't have a great team. We have some good teams. And, it was mainly the Bulldogs of Melbourne all year. And what I loved about Melbourne, they kept winning the big games all year. But I now feel like this is a great team. Now, let's see what happens in the next 5 years. They've played the best football I've seen, certainly since Geelong in that 2007-11. That's all due respect to Hawthorn and Richmond and all the success they've had since then. We haven't seen a more exciting team than Geelong were at their absolute prime, and maybe they're even a cut above them. So it was breathtaking. And like you say, it's a hard grand final to get your head around because of the 74-point margin, and the fact that it was such a contest.
It was an extraordinary game. It was the first one that you haven't called in a long time. Did you miss it?
I did, Tim. Yeah, I really did. I missed the football all year when I was watching. I didn't miss it during the week like I thought I might, but I certainly missed the grand final. Oh, boy. I was climbing up the wall, but I was enjoying it. Halfway through the third quarter, I nearly rang Lewis Martin and said, "Hey, Louis,
patch me in."
But BC and JB were going so well, I reckon I would have had trouble getting rid of those two.
It is great to hear your thoughts. From my point of view, it's especially great. I mean, that's high praise indeed for some individuals in the team, but it is great to hear your thoughts on the footy, and we're going to hear your thoughts on racing. And Tim and I, we love it. We like racing. We love it at this time of the year. We don't follow it throughout the year like obviously you do and others. Can you explain to our audience the impact that the Everest has had? And we understand that it's a Peter Volandi's driven introduction of a new event to try and take some of the gloss away, or not gloss, but try and to shine the light on New South Wales racing. And he's done a marvellous job. How big is the race?
Well, it's probably Sydney. Well, Sydney's biggest race, Gary, and that says a lot. I mean, they've had the Golden Slipper and the Doncaster, and they've been the two biggest races, and the Queen Elizabeth has sort of grown as well. But look, just in a nutshell, I think Sydney looked at the fact that in October there's no football. And this is when it's the racing season for a month. Autumn racing's just as strong, but we don't have the same attention because the footy's just started. So yeah. New South Wales thought, hang on a sec, our spring finishes at the beginning of October with the Epsom Handicap. How can we extend it? What can we do? Now, we can't create another Melbourne Cup or Caulfield Cup or Cox Plate. Where do we go outside the square? So he introduced this race called the Everest, but where he made it so different was that it was the slot holders, the fact that 12 people paid $1.8 million for a three-year deal, $600,000 a year. They could then select these horses. He put out $10 million in the first year with a promise to keep growing it. It's up to $15 million. So he created a buzz. He's then, off the Everest, introduced races like the Golden Eagle worth $7.5 million for four-year-olds. Good idea. Four-year-olds didn't have their own race. Other races have spawned. So he's taken the narrative away just from the Melbourne Cup and the Caulfield Cup and the Cox Plate. And by having the slot holders and all the toing and froing, it becomes a narrative that goes on for about 6 months. It is a stroke of genius. So, look, it has grown to the point where it probably does slightly shade the Caulfield Cup tomorrow, certainly if you're living in Sydney. Not for a purist like myself. I mean, I look at them probably equally tomorrow, but it's been remarkable. So it's extended Sydney deep into October. It's changed a lot of other things in the industry, and it's certainly ruffled up Melbourne's feathers. But I think they've responded really well, Melbourne. And we look at tomorrow, I think the two races sit side by side really well. A Caulfield Cup that's been going for over 140 years and an Everest that's in its fifth year. So, yeah, that's, the, I guess, where the origins of it all.
And the Everest being a sprinting race, a star-studded, these are like, from a track and field point of view, the big guns that come out and it's over pretty quickly, and led by Nature Strip, who's a bit of an enigma of a horse. How do you see it, and what's the track going to be like? Has there had the sort of rain that they were predicting in Sydney?
It's a big question, Gary, because it's a heavy eight at the moment. And that probably takes a couple of horses out of the race, like Wild Ruler. Trekking's going to struggle on that ground. Libertini. But it really brings to the fore Nature Strip, Eduardo, Guitra. And Classic Legends, he doesn't want it too heavy. But look, he is an enigma, Nature Strip. He's gone from much maligned to much loved, to be honest. And that's Chris Waller. He's been a genius in the way that he's worked on him. He's taken him from being a one-trick pony to being more versatile. But this has been not a good race for Nature Strip. He's been beaten twice in the race. He hasn't run a place. I feel like he's going a little better this year than he was last year. I'm sure he is. But it's a powerful field. Half a dozen coming back from last year, including the winner, Classique Legend. And that's probably the biggest story of the race, guys, because the horse hasn't started for over 300 days. He went to Hong Kong. He had a lot of problems there. He came back. And Les Bridge is 83 years of age. He's sort of like our Bart of today. He's laconic. He's quick-witted. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame this year. He's already won a Golden Slipper and a Melbourne Cup. He's the only person alive, actually, the only trainer to win a Golden Slipper, a Melbourne Cup and an Everest. And he's trying to do something that no horse has ever done in the short time, is win the Everest first up. So, and Kerry McAvoy, who rides Classic Legend, has won three of the four. He's won three Melbourne Cups and three Everest. So he's not bad for the bank manager, and he's pretty good as a jockey. So I would have thought Classic Legend and Nature Strip are the two biggest stories in the race.
And we need to get to the Caulfield Cup and your thoughts on that. But Masked Crusader, who we spoke with Wayne Hawks earlier in the week, and his ability to do Chautauqua-like things from the back of the field, maybe compromised a bit because of the track.
Slightly. He'll be okay if it's a soft seven. Heavy eight, well, he might be all right. But look, he is a phenomenal horse. And he and the Inferno are going to be charging with Classic Legend. And that's the thing, Tim and Gary. It's going to be a race where Eduardo and Nature Strip are going to be up the front with probably Home Affairs, and you're going to have a lot of the favourites at the back, and they're going to come somewhere together on the finish line. It's very Sydney. It's bold and brash and it's quick, as you said, Gary, and all over and done with, and $15 million up for grabs. So, and the Caulfield Cup, it's a good renewal, guys. This is a very good race.
Peter Moody's got a habit of finding a horse that just keeps on winning. How good is Incentivise and how good can it be?
It's the best question in racing, and the biggest one. This horse 6 months ago was a forlorn maiden. He'd had three starts and no one would have given two bob for him. And here he is. He's won eight consecutive races by big margins in Queensland. Each was more impressive. He came down to Moody. Some well-known owners chipped in and bought the horse for a lot of money after his sort of run in Queensland. He came down here. Pete's got hold of him from his very good mate who still is in the ownership, Steve Tregay. And how good is he? Well, he's won the Maccabi Diva and he's won the Turnbull. He hasn't won by margins, but he's been authoritative. He could be anything. But we're going to find out tomorrow. This is D-Day because he's got the bad draw. And we're going to, he's got the top weight, but it's not a huge weight. He's well-weighted, actually. We're going to find out how good he is because this is a very strong field, in my opinion, with a lot of horses in good form. But if he does win, Peter will win a Caulfield Cup for the first time to go with all those great things he'd done with Black Caviar, Typhoon Tracy and Dissident, so, particularly Black Caviar. So it'll be a crowning moment for him.
His speech may be one for the ages too, if that was to happen, Bruce.
Well, if he really tells us what he thinks, it could be anything. Because, I mean, he carried a lot of baggage for a long time, Peter did. I mean, we all love Pete. And when I say baggage, I mean, he felt like the wrong thing had been done by him. He felt that, you know, his career had been shattered. He felt like his reputation ruined. And he worked very hard to get it back. And he went to the media and we all loved working with him. And we didn't think he'd come back to training. And then within about 12 months, anyway, said, oh, if I come back, I'll just poke around and have a few horses for the country. We knew that wasn't going to happen because that's not Pete. But, Tim, it'll be a lot of emotion going through him if he does win tomorrow because he's had the roller coaster ride. But we're all just thrilled that he's back because we love having him around. He's a larger-than-life figure. He's got a big, big heart, and he's a brilliant trainer.
We might need to get Shawnee on the dump button if that happens, Bruce.
Who's going to put Shawnee on the dump button? That's a problem. I have been talking to him regularly.
Yes.
And if incentivizes the favourite tomorrow, I can tell you that Shawnee is without doubt the number one frustrated person in Australia right now. And I hope the Premier's not listening, but Shawnee's not his biggest fan at the moment. He hasn't been able to go to the pub for ages.
Who are the other main chances in the Caulfield Cup?
Well, Ollie's got a massive... I wouldn't want to be with Ollie at the moment. He's been starving himself for 4 days. He's grumpy anyway, Ollie. I mean, how would you like that? But he's on Delphi, a horse from Europe who's really, in four runs, has made a mark here. So that's with the Freedman. So Delphi, Nonconformist, and Duas and Young Werther, I reckon, are the five main chances. Duas is a heck of a story, guys. She ran on Wednesday. The last horse to win the Coogee and win the Caulfield Cup was in 1899, so there you go. But this is another one of Bart Cummings' grandsons. Edward Cummings, Bart got the record. Of course, he's got the record for the Caulfield Cup. He's won seven of them. So if Edward were to win with Duas, it would be real racing history. So I reckon Delphi, Nonconformist, and Duas are the dangers to incentivise. It's going to be a great, great race.
And our great friend Andrew Bensley, who I know you'd have great respect for, says Montefilia is the forgotten horse in all of this. So at $16 with Jai McNeil on board, that's the one he likes.
And she's won three Group 1s. She's won the Metrop and all those races. And look, she's certainly in the mix. And what he says sums up the Cup. It's a deep race. It's got a long, long list of chances. And she is certainly one of them. And a four-year-old mare like Duas, they can run very well in this race. So, yeah, look, it's good times, guys. I mean, no international horses, and yet I don't feel the race has suffered at all.
It's going to be a great day, Bruce, and you're going to be at the forefront of it all for Channel 7 and 7 Plus, and we'll be watching. And it's a great thrill to talk to you. We miss you, and we appreciate you giving us some time this morning.
Pleasure, Gary. All the best, Timmy.
Thanks, Michael. Boys.
Oh, I've got to try and get into the head of Melbourne Marathon swimming superstar Chloe McArdle, who set a new record for swimming the English Channel, which is 34-kilometre stroll in the English Channel. She's done it for the 44th time, Wisp, if you don't mind. That is extraordinary. She joins us on the line. Good morning to you, Chloe.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on.
I can't imagine what it would be like to jump into the English Channel and swim. On this occasion, took you just over 10 hours, I reckon. What's the motivation for doing this?
Well, when I was 19, I decided I wanted to be the best in the world at something, and I had a background as a teenager as a competitive pool swimmer. And so I tried a few sports, elite triathlon, and I was terrible at that. I got out in front for the swim leg and then the bike and the run, everything went downhill. Then I ran a marathon, the pretty good time, 3:37. Swam the marathon, wow. I was like, this is it. This is the sport I can excel at. And I also had this incredible, amazing connection to the environment, the open water, and I really felt like I found the sport that could propel me to greatness.
44 Was this one of the easiest crossings for you, 10 hours, 1 minute?
The conditions were definitely above average. They were definitely favourable. But in saying that, like, I did have swell for 4 to 5 hours. The chop was about 1 metre. So it was a bit, like, messy during that. But there was nothing that was going to dampen my spirit yesterday my time. It doesn't matter if there were 3 metre waves. I was still even smiling all the way to France.
I don't like getting out there in the sea. I see a little shadow lurking and I get a little bit frightened about what it may or may not be. Does that ever concern you when you're out there swimming?
Not really. I understand where you're coming from. You know, I totally get that. A lot of open water swimmers scream if seaweed touches them. So, you know, that's a common thing. You're in good company. I mean, I've done the longest non-stop ocean swim in the Bahamas. So I swam through 2 nights where I knew that there were deadly sharks just cruising around. And, you know, I was just hoping that when my limbs went through the water that they would still be there when I finished my arm stroke. So, I'm not particularly scared of sharks. I don't think they hunt humans. I think whatever shark attacks do happen, they're accidental. And I'm happy to take my chances.
Hey, Chloe, you now got the world record of 44 crossings. Has the thought crossed your mind that maybe you just stay over there, do another 5 or 6 and just make it sort of a lot more difficult for anyone ever to break the record again?
Well, yeah, I'm telling everyone I'm retiring and most people are not believing me. I guess when you do something 44 times, people think you'll just keep doing it indefinitely. But there has to be an end point, right? So I've just got to the point where I'm like, well, you know, I want to have more of a life. I have terrible work-life balance. I'm in England 3 months of the year. You know, I'm leaving everything in Australia and I travel by myself because I'm on a tiny budget. And, you know, it's really hard. So, no, I don't have any plans. 3 people behind me are all retired and haven't swum in 15 years, the English Channel. And there's no one close coming up behind me. So the next closest person who actively swims in the English Channel is about 20 crossings of the channel.
You've done it 7 times on the crossing this year in pursuit of this record. And I don't want to pry, but I mean, it would be a costly exercise, Chloe, would it not, to put all this together? And as you say, you stayed over there for 3 months. So how does that all work?
Yeah, it's phenomenally expensive. And my sport is not recognised by Swimming Australia, which means that not only do I get no scholarship, no funding, you know, no sports science, because what I do really pushes the boundaries. I would really need sports science to be able to perform at my best. And I feel like I haven't got the career I could have had because there's just so much resources I have never had access to that really could have supported me more. So that's been financially extremely difficult and very taxing. But I have a few sponsors that are really good to me, like David Paradise, for example, a local company, Local, based out of Marrickville in Sydney, and they've been really good to me. So, and a lot of everyday people will help me where they can. They may hit me here, I need help, and you know, they'll send me $200. Like a swimming club got together, pitched $200 together and sent it to me. I'm like, thanks, guys, you're awesome. So, you know, if there's enough willpower, things can happen.
Hey, Chloe, what do you reckon makes a great marathon swimmer or somebody that pursues something like you've pursued?
I think marathon swimming, by definition, is a pioneering activity in the open water. To me, it's not about racing around in circles. It was inducted into the Olympic program a few cycles ago. So officially, it's a sport. But what they did was, in my mind, they just reduced the quality and value of marathon swimming. So a marathon used to be considered either 16 kilometres or 25 kilometres at minimum. So the marathon event in the Olympics is 10 kilometres, for example. So it's just really fast pool swimmers that have converted to open water and they swim around 4 laps and then, you know, they're done, that's 10 kilometres done. But traditionally, marathon swimming was all about pushing the boundaries. So they used to say in the 1800s, no person would ever swim the English Channel. Like, it's just not possible. And then the first man did it in 1875. And then they said, no woman has the constitution to ever do this crossing. And then the first woman crossed it in 1926 and beat all the men by 2 hours. And so I guess it's part of that draws me to the sport or keeps inspiring me to stay in the sport, is that, you know, you can be a pioneer in this sport and push the boundaries, and then also push the boundaries of what's possible for the human body and human mind. And to me, that's been part of my journey. Like, I love being competitive and setting records, but that experience of you know, going through that journey and what it takes to get to the next level and what it takes to push the boundaries is just, for me, really fascinating. And I think that's the spirit of marathon swimming.
Talking to Chloe McArdle, who set a new record for swimming the English Channel after completing her 44th crossing on Wednesday. How busy does it get out there? How many people were crossing the channel, in the last week? Was there anybody out there at all?
I think it was three others on the day I swam, the 44th, yesterday. I swam my 43rd crossing 1 week earlier only, and there was no one else out that day. It was a horrific day, and I got a chest infection the very next day. So that was one of the worst swims I've done. We're now in mid-autumn, so very few people want to swim the English Channel. The air temps are very cold, especially at night and early in the morning. The weather is even more fickle than normal, and the water temperature is dropping very quickly. I mean, it's always low here, but it's dropping to quite low. So at this time of the year in October, it's not a common thing for swimmers to be crossing the channel.
What's that stuff you lather all over yourself, Chloe? Is that to keep you warm?
It's called channel grease. So that's a mixture of pure lanolin, which is a byproduct of the wool industry, and Vaseline. And traditionally, people thought, just as you're saying, that, you know, it can help with heat retention and et cetera, et cetera. But there's never been any science to back that up. So I still use a bit of that in the areas that I chafe. Because if you can consider swimming, for example, I'll do 36,000 arm strokes just across the English Channel once. So all those rotation and friction points. Then you add water, which increases friction. And then you add seawater, which is salty. So, you know, like that's a very, there's a lot of pressure on your body. So I use it, but it's purely to prevent basically gouges coming out of my skin from rotation. Mm.
Well, that's good to know, because Tim lathered himself up to go to the local pool because he doesn't like the water that cold. So you can stop doing that now, Tim. What about when you're in the water for 10 hours? Talk us through some of the practicalities of eating and hydrating and all that sort of stuff. Can you tell us what you eat, what you drink, how many times you stop for a little food stop?
Yes, so it's really hard to swim in the English Channel to even get an opportunity. Over the years, I book usually two or three years in advance. The reason is it's tightly controlled. Only 12 boats are allowed out on any one day. Most days are not considered swimmable, so there's very few swimming days and very few opportunities to swim. You've got to book your slot first when you get a boat and a boat captain. So you have this boat ready to go when you're ready to swim. And on that boat, you've got two boat captains, a sports official we call an observer. So they count stroke rate every hour. They check for hypothermia, which is a serious potential issue that swimmers may get. It's been deadly. I've been put into ICU in Canterbury in England because of that condition. So it's really important. And then you have the people on your boat to feed, support, motivate you. And they're the ones that mix your feeds together. So by feeds, I mean liquids or solids, whatever you want as a swimmer to sustain you as you're swimming along the English Channel. And I prefer liquid feeds because the energy is more readily available if it comes in liquid form. But occasionally I might have half a comfort or something as I'm swimming along the channel. So that those feeds happen every 30 minutes. I try and make them quite quick, 20, 30 seconds, because we get pushed so much by the tide. If I'm there for a minute or two having a joke and a laugh, it actually changes my position unfavourably. And then extends the course of my channel swim. No one wants to swim any longer than they have to in the channel.
Chloe, just
the feeding side of it.
Oh, sorry, keep going. Yeah.
Yeah, the feeding side of it. Some interesting other things is we usually start at nice in the dark. So often I'm swimming 6-8 hours through the dark into the sunrise. The sunrise in the English Channel is absolutely sight to behold. It's incredible. We swim through the two biggest shipping lanes in the world, and they go in opposite directions. So we have to give way to the cargo ships, the tankers, because they need up to a kilometre to come to a complete stop. So they're not manoeuvrable. So we weave through those shipping lanes. We also weave through the Dover-Calais ferry strait, which is going over the top of those shipping lanes. And obviously they have right of way as well. So, I mean, yeah, there's lots of things I could talk all day about the English Channel. I'm sure there's other things you want to talk about on your show.
Hey, Chloe, we've got to move on. But before we go, what's the first thing you're looking forward to doing now? What do you think you're going to do now?
I'm really loving keynote speaking. It's something I've been doing for quite a few years. So I love getting into businesses and schools and sharing my journey and inspiring others. So when I get back to Australia, I'm already lining up quite a bit of that for the end of this year and next year. So, yeah.
Well, Chloe, you've inspired our audience. People, we get real-time feedback, and they're loving your story. I've got people saying they want to donate to your cause. So if you can leave your details with our producer, and we'll put it on all our social pages. And I know there's a lot of people that want to support what you're doing, and I think they'd love the book you as a speaker. You've been outstanding this morning, so thanks for giving us some time.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
After the trade period, we always announce the Golden Feather winner for the list manager who's done the best job during trade period. And then the most sought after of all, I think, the Scott Palmer for the footy journo, who's had the best trade period. And Wispy, it is with great pleasure that we can announce, after what's been a difficult time for this footy club for a couple of years, let's be honest, the Carlton Footy Club's Nick Austin is the winner of the Golden Feather. They got Adam Chera into their footy club. They got George Hewitt into their footy club. Lewis Young, they traded out pick six. But the Blues hold selections 25 and 64, and it's a very nice award to win. Nick is still feverishly working on the draft, so on his behalf, Brad Lloyd is accepting the Golden Feather. Welcome, Bradley, and congratulations.
Yeah, thanks very much, Gary, Tim. I jumped at the opportunity to accept on behalf of Nick, so, fantastic. As you say, a bit of a challenging year, but finish off with this is a great honour.
It's a large hat with a big feather sticking out of it that Simon Lethlean still wears with great pride in the off-season. So we'll hand that on. But you must be happy. You're satisfied with the job done. I mean, in a trade period that didn't have an enormous amount going on, I think you guys have done a good job there.
Yeah, no, really, really happy. We just first with George, like just sort of his hardness, and that gives us that extra midfield depth and the way he goes about it. So, come out of it. Great club like the Sydney Swans, so really excited about him. And the free agency, not using a pick, is that real bonus with him. And then Adam Chera, with his class, sort of seen firsthand at Fremantle, and quality person. And he just turned 22 last week, so we think he can be around the club a long, long time. So pretty exciting getting him done nice and early as well. And then Lewis Young, look, we really need to bolster that sort of key defensive stocks, and they're rare and hard to find, and we think he's got some real growth in him. So he's a really good addition to our list.
Yeah, he is. Congratulations, Brad. And it all makes sense now. I came in here earlier this morning. I said to Gary, "There's a little makeup purse here with embossed ML18 on it," and then it all makes sense now because you were here last night, so you've used some of Maddie's makeup as part of your presentation of the Carlton Best and Fairest Award last night. Well done. And Sam Walsh, the winner of the John Nicholls Medal last night too, so congratulations to him this morning.
Yeah, I was in last night. Sat on the panel for the Best and Fairest, and it was a good count. It was a good way to do it with Sarah Ollie, Andy Marr on the panel, and Walshy capped off a sensational year, and I think he's only 21 years of age, and runner up last year. So we all know the quality player he is, and wonderful person, and great family with parents Jackie and Wayne, and rap for him. And we had Wearing had another good year, and also Harry with his Coleman medal. I think he's only 23 years of age, but look, obviously, finals is where we want to go from a footy club point of view. But, it was a great night to round out the season.
Good on you, Bradley. I know you're a modest lad, so we don't keep you any longer when you're accepting on behalf of Nick Austin. But things on the up here for this footy club. You've started to turn it around, and we can now add the Golden Feather. That's the impetus, Tim, I think, for driving this club forward.
Is the plumage on the way, Gary?
The plumage, the plumage. It's getting, it's at the
dry
taxidermist
cleaning.
At the moment, and we'll hand it on. Thanks for joining us, Bradley.
Very, very good. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Brad.
So there you go. Well done. We think Carlton have done best here. And then the Scott Palmer winner. This is hotly, hotly chased after. This is for the journalist that has had the best job. Calculating Cal was in calculations. Reliable Beverage was one who really came forward this year, put his hand up, and almost caused a boil over.
And Tommy Topbox was in there as well.
Topbox Brown was there until he got relocated to bottom box, and that probably cost him in the end. But the winner is Fox Footy's Tom Morris, the Scott Palmer medal winner. What a thrill for you, Thomas.
Oh, Gaz, Tim, this is a huge honour. I don't have a nickname like the others, though. I think you guys need to come up with something.
Well, we'll start working on it now that you're a Scott Palmer medalist. broke the exclusive that the deal had been done between Jordan Dawson, the Crows and the Swans, and you also broke Marby Achol heading up the Gold Coast, amongst others. How did you rate the trade period?
The trade period from a media perspective or the trade period from a footy perspective?
Just all round, you know. You're the Scott Palmer medal winner. You can do it. You can rate it however you want.
It was the most uneventful trade period we've probably had in 7 or 8 years, wasn't it? But there's always some sort of action, and I think as anyone at SEN or Trade Radio or AFL.com or anywhere would attest to, it didn't mean that people weren't interested. The numbers were huge for it, and there wasn't the big fish, but it was still interesting to be a part of something that maybe didn't have the big fish but still had some stories going around. I think that what spiced it up in the end was Bobby Hill wanting to get to Victoria. I mean, that story came out on the Friday. And by the weekend, it was confirmed that Essendon was his club. And then by the sort of the Wednesday afternoon, it was off. So that really spiced it up. We needed something. Hopefully next year's a bit more busy with maybe a couple of big fish, a couple of big free agents.
All right, Tommy, you can't win these awards on your own. Is there anyone you'd like to thank?
Tim, yes, absolutely. I'd like to thank Ben Waterworth and Max Lawton at Fox Sports. I think Callum Toomey and Riley Beveridge would be pretty hard done by here. I think they had a great trade period. Nick Gleeson as well, Sammy Edmund. So this is a very hotly contested award, and it's an honour to win it. And it's just great to be part of an industry which is so many talented sports journalists.
I know that Gary's been mentoring you over the years. What's the best bit of advice that he's given you so far?
Don't sit on a story. That's his number one bit of advice. If you have it, go with it. Don't wait. And it happened with the Bobby Hill story on the Friday. I had that he was going to Victoria, or that he wanted to go to Victoria, and I was on the golf course, and I sent 4 pars through to Ben Waterworth. He quickly put it up, and I just got it ahead of anyone else. So Gary Lyon's been a huge influence in my career, and I don't think I would have got this story without that bit of advice.
Proud moment. So what we will now do on the basis of this is we'll put it out to our smartest audience in media for a nickname for you. There's a couple that have come through. Tom Minor Morris. I don't like that. That hasn't got the right connotation. Tenacious Tommy Morris. They're coming through at the moment, yes.
Yeah, they're coming through thick and fast. And before we let Tom go, one of the things that the Scotty Palmer winner does every year is he gives us a little bit of a keep punching. Can you just give us a keep punching before you go, Tommy, please?
Keep punching.
Beautiful.
There it is, the 2021 Scott Palmer medal winner, and what a great thrill it is. Thanks, Thomas, for your time. He will go back and, I tell you, if we weren't in lockdown, he'd tie one on for a good 2 or 3 days on the back of that magnificent victory. The award winners were all here for the new Kia Niro electric SUV range. Available as a hybrid, plug-in hybrid and full electric. You mentioned Sam Walsh, Carlton's best and fairest winner from Wietering and Mackay. I mean, that gives you an idea why Carlton's fans get frustrated that they haven't done better, because that's a trio of young talent as good as any that you can put together. Cripps came fourth, which may be surprising, but I guess the next ones you why. So the first three, yes, and then you go Cripps at fourth, Ed Curnow at fifth. So I think if the Carlton Footy Club are going to be finishing in the finals and competing, and as much as we love Ed Curnow, they're going to need a few of those other boys to bob up into that top five. Plowman beat Jones, which was my Carlton people tell me of great interest.
That's a bit of a surprise.